Good morning. Welcome to the Australian Early Finance Briefing for Wednesday, the 22nd of July, 2020. My name is Nick Hurley here in Melbourne. Starting with our biggest source of national income, natural resources. Keith Pitt, the Federal Resources Minister, was interviewed by the Financial Times a couple of days ago, talking about the sort of the massive surge we've seen in iron ore exports. It's expected that the Department of Industry will show that mining and energy exports hit a record of almost 300 billion Australian dollars in the 12 months to the end of June, and iron ore alone will exceed 100 billion. Now, it's worth noting that that's a phenomenal growth. In 2017-18, it was only about 60 billion. 61 billion, which was about the same as coal exports. So we've seen almost in terms of, you know, Australian dollar value, an almost doubling in only a couple of years. The Financial Times sort of reiterates the importance of sort of this to our sort of resilience through the coronavirus downturn. The iron ore industry, or the natural resources industry overall, employs over 240,000 direct jobs in Australia, and they've pretty much kept all those jobs. There hasn't been many losses in that sector. So it's another sort of sign of optimism, or, you know, a source of optimism for the Australian economy looking ahead. The article does mention something we've brought up in recent episodes, the interest of China to diversify its sources. You know, we're sort of a monopsonistic supplier to China for iron ore. We supply apparently about 62% of their imports, which is obviously a very big amount. And if there was, you know, a major trade dispute, even if we were to say, you know, ban exports to China in the unlikely event, that would have a profound impact on the entire sort of industrial machine of China. So there is that sort of risk that we will sort of have that there will be Africa projects there coming online that are huge and of similar or greater size than the Pilbara sort of operations. So we do have that threat to look out to, but it's sort of only to be expected. And anyone in such an envious position as we are in terms of iron ore will naturally, you know, we'll see that sort of happening. Moving on to taxation reform, which is sort of quite a recurring narrative in the national conversation at the moment. The Sydney Morning Herald and The Age ran an article earlier this week on a study by the Tax and Transfer Policy Institute, which is part of ANU in Canberra. And they found that young people are effectively bankrolling the advantages enjoyed by older people, who in some cases are getting tax benefits worth more than their savings, i.e., you know, dividend franking credits. They're proposing a new sort of round of taxation reform where superannuation, dividends and savings would be taxed separately from wages and salaries. So this is in order to avoid the poorest and youngest people being hit with the highest sort of marginal tax rates. So the main issue with this is that they cite is that there's a distortionary effect of the current taxation system, where a lot of investment decisions are driven purely by taxation and not by the, you know, economic benefit of those decisions, which is obviously not great. They found that a person earning between $20,000 and $37,000 faces a marginal effective tax rate on their savings of almost 14%. Yet if you were earning over $180,000, that tax rate would only be less than 6%. So they propose that the income tax would remain a progressive system, similar to what we have now, but taxes on savings would be a single flat rate. There would also be substantial changes to superannuation, with all contributions to be made from post-tax income, with some upfront subsidies to help ease some of the financial hit from such a move. And taxes for superannuation contributions for younger people would be lower. Dividend imputation would be replaced with a flat rate on dividends, removing other differences between those in the workforce and those who have retired. Now, the federal government is due to sort of announce a retirement income review this week. Obviously, we have the, you know, the current government has a lot of their voter bloc is the older Australians, and sort of refuting Labor's proposal to change the franking credit system for people with no income. How that was sort of flatly refused by the electorate. It seems very unlikely that there will be a lot of these sorts of proposals either agreed to or implemented by the current government. Okay, on to indexing. So all ETFs typically will have a reference index that they either track, or even, you know, managed funds have a benchmark reference index. Now, there's been a lot of industry consolidation in these index, the operators of these indexes in recent years, and it's basically now there's three big players, MSCI, you know, famous for MSCI World, S&P, famous for the S&P ASX 200 and the S&P 500, and the FTSE Russell, you know, famous small cap index in the US, and then the FTSE, the London main index there. Interestingly, Tesla is not in the S&P 500, contrary to what many people would probably assume. Now, what's the impact of that? So if they're not in the index, then fund managers that are sort of tracking their performance against the S&P can easily outperform if they buy a lot of Tesla, if they're permitted to. Now, if you're Elon Musk, you'd be really wanting your company to be listed in the S&P 500, because it instantly means you're going to receive huge capital inflows, because there's so many ETFs have to buy the name then, and you know, active managers still need to track their benchmark typically. So Tesla currently has a market value of $278 billion, which would mean that it should, you know, it's likely to go in. So an index isn't something simple. It's not just the top names in a stock exchange. Well, it is, but how do you actually define that? There's lots and lots of rules. And that's the reason why you can't just sort of just start an index and have people sort of know what they're following. You need to know how that index is constructed to actually sort of know what it's actually doing. So, for example, the S&P 500 doesn't have 500 names. It has 505 names. That's because names such as Under Armour have two shares of stock. Now, people in the know that, because S&P is a famous index. That's great. But let's say, I don't know, Westpac started their Westpac 500 US index. People would be like, what is this? How does a company qualify? We don't really know. So these companies have a really, the established players have a really cemented sort of barrier to entry around them, just because they're known and trusted, and people know what goes in these indices and you know what makes it qualify in and what makes it qualify to go out. The problem with it is now so much money is following these indices. So, for example, there's $8.5 trillion is now held in funds benchmarked to various indices, representing 41% of the fund's industry assets. And just equity index funds account for 14% of the US domestic equity market, which is up from less than 4% in 2005. So obviously, you know, ETFs are great for low cost sort of, you know, beta performance. But what does that actually mean for the sort of the power of these index operators? And we saw a really interesting sort of example in China, when the MSCI World up until 2018 didn't include the China A shares in their index. When they finally came around to including that, lo and behold, it added $80 billion in foreign inflows into the China stock market. So there's immense power, and it doesn't seem to be particularly monitored or acknowledged in the market. However, in Europe, the European Union are looking in a number of different areas of sort of regulating index construction. Obviously, we had LIBOR, which is an index essentially, was manipulated and caused huge amount of issues. So they've seen the risk in that, and they're looking at sort of putting some sort of measures into index construction. It's very easy if you understand how indexes are constructed. You can predict for a lot of them what names are going in and what names are going out, and you can front run the market and generate alpha from doing that. And moving to the markets now, it's looking really great in the US. About 20 minutes after open, the S&P is up 67 basis points, and the Russell is up almost 1.5%. The Australian dollar's busted through that resistance. It's now at 71 US cents, which is the highest it's been in about a year. And in commodities, things are looking great there. Gold is up 1% at $1,838 US dollars. But there's also a huge surge in copper, silver, and oil. Dare I say, we've got the combined impact of sort of the market digesting the vaccine news from Oxford University and the EU stimulus package that was announced as well. But everything's looking very green this morning. And coming up in announcements today, we have Australian retail sales, which last month were up a lot, up 17%. Maybe not quite as much this month with the Victorian revised lockdown coming into place. And that is your early finance briefing for Wednesday. Have a great day.
This podcast is for investment professionals only and should not be relied upon by private investors. The podcast is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute financial advice. The values of investments can go up or down, so you may get back less than you initially invest.